بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Picking up where we left off, the next item for us to discuss in the chapter of purification is tayammum, dry ablution. You know, what happens if we are unable to have access to water and we are in need of wudu? So he says, قَالَ الْمُصَنِّفُ رَحِمَهُ اللَّهُ وَنَفَعْنَا بِعُلُومِهِ فِي الدَّارَيْنِ آمِينَ. Dry ablutions, the conditions. There are five conditions for making the dry ablution, the tayammum. The first one is the existence of an excuse such as traveling or sickness. So you're traveling. Usually when you travel, usually you don't have water. So that's why it's one of the things that allow you to make tayammum is because the state of travel, usually you're not have access to water because you're an artificial vehicle, and you know you're traveling long distances. There are maybe some rest stops, maybe some of them have water, some of them don't. Or you have water with you, but you need the water to drink, or you need it for medicine, or you need it for your children, you need it to cook. So that would be a valid excuse. You have water, but you can't use it, or there is no water. And then he says, or sickness. So sickness is, I'm sick, and I using the water will make me more sick. That's the first condition. Second condition is the time for the prayer has entered. So you cannot make tayammum before the time of prayer, because unlike wudu, tayammum does not lift the state of ritual impurity. It doesn't lift the hadath. It has a lesser power. It just simply allows you to pray. So therefore, you have to wait for the adhan to come in. And then number three, seeking water. So you have to make an effort to seek water. Like if I'm at home or at the masjid, and for some reason there's no water, you have to make some effort. You know, maybe this bathroom doesn't have, maybe does a neighbor have, do the neighbors have water? If you have a facility where it's upstairs and downstairs, is upstairs is there water? So you have to make some kind of effort to seek the water. Number four, an excuse or the incapacity to use the water after seeking it. So maybe you find the water, but it's too cold, or you find the water and it's boiling hot, or you find the water and there's like a bad smell, or something's like mixed in with it from the pipes or something like that. There's an excuse. There's something that prevents you from using the water. And then lastly, the existence of pure earth containing dirt. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, we restrict the ard here, the matter on which we can use the tayammum to earth, pure earth in which there is dirt on it. And if it is mixed with gypsum or sand, it does not suffice. So dirt that's mixed with other stuff, we can't use that for wudu. It's got to be pure earth. Okay, what are the obligatory acts? There are four. Number one, obviously, you have to have your intention. Number two is you have to wipe the face, the same definition of the face that we talked about in wudu. And number three, you have to wipe the hands up, and from the fingers, the wrist, all the way up into slightly past the elbow for both the right and the left. And you have to do it in that order. So, you tap the ground once and you wipe your face, you tap the ground a second time, and then you do your arms, hands and arms. That's it, that's the tayammum. If you do that, then you are allowed to pray. Now there are some sunnahs involved with the tayammum. So the recommended acts is number one, saying Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Number two is wiping the right before the left. And then number three is performing the actions consecutively. We talked about consecutively in the first lecture. So all of what I said in the first lecture for consecutive acts will, you know, passes through all of the Sharia. Okay, invalidate. What invalidates? How can you lose your tayammum? Three things invalidate the tayammum, the dry ablution. Number one, anything that invalidates ablution. So you pass gas, you use the bathroom, you fall asleep, etc. Number two, you find water before praying. So you're about to stand and say Allahu Akbar, and then you hear that the waters come back. So now that the water exists, khalas, at that moment, the tayammum doesn't count. You got to go make wudu. And number three, apostasy. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect us. And, you know, the fuqaha, they like to be thorough. So obviously, if somebody left Islam after they made, you know, ablution, may Allah ta'ala protect us from that, they have bigger problems to worry about than their tayammum. Okay, the next topic is splints, bandages, casts. We call it al-jaba'ir in the Sharia. So what happens if you have like a cut or something like that in part of your body that needs to be washed for wudu, and you can't remove that bandage, what do you do? So that's what this is about. Someone with a splint or a bandage or a cast wipes over that splint or cast or bandage, performs dry ablution, and then prays. He is not required to repeat the prayer if the splint and the other stuff was applied while in a state of wudu and is not on the limbs upon which dry ablution is made, the face, the arms, and the elbows. So let's say I cut my toe really bad and I had to get some stitches and I have to cover it, and the doctor said, this type of stitch, you're not allowed to get wet. Okay, so I can't wipe my feet for wudu. So I would do a complete wudu, but when I would get to that foot, I would just wipe over it or wipe over the bandage. Then I would go make tayammum, the way we just described, and I would pray. If the bandage was placed on my foot while I had wudu, then I would not have to repeat my prayers that I prayed in this fashion. If I put the bandage on when I did not have wudu, I still do everything that we just said. Inshallah, there's no sin, but those prayers, because of the deficiency, they need to be repeated. Now, if I have something on my face, a bandage on my face or my hands and arms, those are the parts of the body for tayammum. So, same thing, you do wudu, you wipe over it, you do tayammum, and in the tayammum you wipe over it, but there's a deficiency because you weren't able to fully do the tayammum, and therefore you have to make up that prayer. So when we say to make up that prayer, it doesn't mean that the prayer that you prayed in this fashion is wrong. You had to do that, ihtiraman lilwaqt, out of respect for the time, but there was a deficiency, there was something that was not accurate, not because of your doing, because, you know, Allah Ta'ala had ordained that on you, so therefore you make up the prayer. Okay, dry ablution and prayers. One makes one dry ablution for each obligatory prayer, and you can pray as many sunnah prayers as you wish with a single dry ablution. So the tayammum has a capacity of time, a certain amount of time in which it's valid. You pray the fard and as many sunnah prayers that you want. When the next fard comes, you have to do another tayammum. Why? Because the tayammum does not lift the state of ritual impurity. It just allows the prayer to be performed. So it's a lesser strength than the wall. Okay, types of filth. Anything wet that exits from the genital is considered filth. Filth is maybe a direct verbatim translation. Najasa is, you should think of it as ritual impurity, because not everything that is najis makes sense rationally. I mean, feces and urines, we would all say, is filth. But there are some things like the saliva of a dog. I mean, there's no real rational reason. It's just we do it because the Prophet ﷺ told us to. So I like to use the word ritual impurity to add the component that there's an aspect of iman and a'tiqad and faith involved. Anything wet that exits from the genitals is filth, except for fluids released during orgasm. So the sexual fluid released during orgasm is not filth, obviously, because that's where we come from. So, or otherwise we would be filthy. And we talked about the human being tahir. Washing all urine and feces is obligatory, except for urine from a male infant who has not eaten solid food. And it may be purified by sprinkling the affected area with water. Now, this is one of those things in which there is no necessarily rational reason why is the male infant that hasn't had solid foods, their urine is not considered filth, but the female's urine, the girl, the infant girl, urine is considered filth, regardless if they've had solid food or not. We just do it out of ta'abbud, out of worship, because there's a hadith that states that. Excusable filth. Filth is inexcusable except for small amounts of blood and pus. Small amounts is like a little coin, maybe about this big. So if you had a little bit of blood or pus on your shirt that was like, you know, this amount or less, that would be excusable. But if it was larger than that, you would have to remove it and clean it. And then number two, living things which do not possess flowing blood, if they fall into a container and die, they do not render it filthy. If a living thing, like let's say you were in a big kitchen, you had like a big vat, and a mouse or a rat, you know, sorry for the example, falls in and dies, khalas, I mean, because the rat and mouse has blood, that would render the whole thing would be najis. But if it's something that doesn't have flowing blood and it dies in there, you just scoop it out and it's permissible and tahir. Animals. All animals are pure except for dogs and pigs, and the offspring of both of them or one of them with a pure animal. So anything that has anything that has a dog and pig involved, whether a dog itself and a pig itself, or the dog mates with another animal, the derivative of that, or the pig mates with another animal, the derivative of that, as long as there's a dog and pig involved, it makes that animal completely najis. It's entirely najis. None of it is considered pure for us. Dead animals which have not been slaughtered are filth, are najis, because they're maita. That's why we can't eat unslaughtered meat, by the way. But dead animals have which have not been slaughtered are filth, except for fish. So anything from the sea is tahir, even if it comes up dead. Locusts and human beings, because we said the human being does not become najis. Removing filth. Containers in which a dog and pig have lapped, meaning they licked it with their tongue and the saliva got in it, are washed 7 times. One of the washings must include dirt, the same dirt as defined in tayammum. Other types of filth are washed once, but washing them 3 times is better. So again, the dog and the pig thing, 7 times, ihdahunna biturab, one of those times with turab, the Prophet ﷺ said, and there's no rational reason behind that. We can think of a hikmah, a wisdom behind it, but what's the reason? When we say reason in fiqh, it's called al-illah. Al-illah is the reason behind the law. Why do we do it? We do it because the Prophet ﷺ told us. So we say it's ta'abudi. There's no rational reason. Why? Because you can say, oh, the dog and pig are not clean, but the chicken is not clean, but we eat the chicken. So that might be a hikmah, but it's not really a satisfactory reason why. So this is one of those things that we just do out of worship. Vinegar. Wine becomes pure when it turns into vinegar on its own. So if you leave something and it ferments long enough, it becomes alcohol is in it. And if you leave the liquid long enough, the wine long enough, the alcohol leaves and it becomes vinegar. If that process happens by itself, then the process of vinegarization makes that permissible for us. And the Prophet ﷺ used to eat vinegar, and he said it was one of the best condiments that you can eat with. So wine becomes pure when it turns into vinegar on its own. It does not become pure if it turns into vinegar because a foreign substance has been added to it. Alcohol or wine is considered najis in the Sharia. So if you place something inside the wine to speed up the process, by placing that foreign object in the wine, that foreign object now has become najis, because it's submerged in najasa, which is alcohol. When the alcohol becomes vinegar, at that moment, the najasa, foreign item, transfers its najasa to the liquid, which is vinegar, so now the vinegar becomes najis. That's why you can't speed it up artificially. This also reminds us of another principle in the Sharia, that wet things cause the najasa to transfer, but dry things do not. So if my hand is dry, and I touch a dog, even though we say the dog is najis, that najasa characteristic of the dog does not transfer to my hand because it's dry. But if the dog was wet, and I touched the dog, then the najasa would have transferred to my hand. Okay. Menstruation and postnatal bleeding. So these are things that involve our sisters. Three types of blood exit from the vagina: menstrual blood, postnatal blood, and irregular. So we'll define them. Menstrual blood is blood that normally exit from a woman's vagina and without being caused by delivery. It is black in color, hot and pungent. When it comes to the color, this is just one color. I mean, there are thousands of colors and iterations. So at the time that Qadi Abi Shuja radiallahu anhu wrote this, I mean, maybe that was just one way of describing it, but it's not necessarily like that, because different women produce different type of experiences. But the fuqaha did get into that level of detail. So in the longer books, the Hawashi of the Madhab, you will find, like Imam Ar-Ramli and others, they'll talk about the different types of, you know, hundreds of shades of colors. And that's how detail-oriented the fuqaha were, or are. And then postnatal bleeding is blood that exits after childbirth. I believe we talked about that yesterday. Now, irregular bleeding, this is the difficult one, istihada, is blood that exits outside of those two. So therefore, we have to define those two in order to understand what would be considered irregular bleeding. The minimum duration of menstruation is 24 hours. So if a woman starts to bleed, the minimum, the shortest amount that menstrual cycle is 24 hours. So she has to wait at least 24 hours to then determine, I'm not going to bleed anymore, and then do ghusl and resume her prayers. The maximum is 15 days. The average is 6 to 7. Now, the average is, you know, dependent on people in different places and time. But I have found that with women, that is more or less the average. 15 days is the maximum. 15 days and 1 minute, if the woman is still bleeding, that extra blood after 15 days is considered irregular bleeding, istihada, not the blood of the menses. So she makes her ghusl, cleans herself, and resumes her prayer. That's why it's important to know the parameter. But if a woman starts bleeding in the morning, and by the evening she stopped and she's like, I'm done, we say, no, you have to wait at least 24 hours, wait till the next day in the morning, because that's defined in the Sharia as the minimal amount of menstruation. Now, the minimum duration between two menstrual cycles is 15 days, and it has no maximum limit, because at a certain age, women become menopausal normally, and therefore they don't have bleeding anymore. So the minimum duration of purity is 15 days. So if a woman starts bleeding, or she starts her cycle for 4 days, and then she stops, and then she prays, makes ghusl and prays, and then 2 days later she starts bleeding again, well, we're still within the 15 days. So this bleeding is part of the past menstrual cycle. There's no sin for washing and praying because you thought, you know, you thought you were over, but it's important to know the parameters. The minimum age at which a woman menstruates is 9 lunar years. So below 9 lunar years, if there is blood, the fuqaha say this is istihada, irregular blood, it doesn't count. The minimum duration for pregnancy is 6 months. The maximum duration is 4 years. The most common duration is 9 months. Now, this is just one of those weird things. You know, I've never heard of a pregnancy lasting 4 years, but this is what Imam Shafi'i said is medically possible, and in very obscure fiqh circumstances, this might be helpful to establish paternity and things like that. Okay, actions unlawful without ritual purity. 8 things are unlawful because of menstruation and postnatal bleeding. So you can't, a woman can't pray, can't fast, can't recite the Quran. Reciting the Quran means to audibly, the way we are speaking audibly now, to recite the Quran, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. That she can't do. But if she reviewed the Quran in her mind silently, that would, or, you know, over her heart, as we say, that's okay. Number 4, touching and carrying the Quran. The Quran is defined as all of the surahs from the Fatiha to the Nas in the Othmanic script in one volume. So if you, you know, a woman would picked up her phone and was reading the, you know, reviewing silently, this is not the Quran because it's an app. This is not what, this is not the one volume that we refer to as the Mus'haf. Or the little ajza, you know, the Quran that's in the 30 paras or the ajza, or sometimes they're in four or five. If you take one of those is not the Mus'haf because that's not the whole Quran, so on and so forth. So again, definitions are very precise when it comes to the Sharia. And then number five, she can't enter the mosque and remain in the mosque. Six, you can't do tawaf around the Kaaba. Seven, you can't have intercourse, of course. And eight, seeking sexual enjoyment from the area between the woman's navel and the knees. So the between the navel and the knees of the woman would have to be covered if she and her husband wanted to become intimate. And five, things are unlawful for someone in the state of major ritual impurity, janaba, which is shared by both men and women. Again, you can't pray, you can't recite the Quran, you can't touch and carry the Quran. We describe what that means. Also, there is no going around the Kaaba, no tawaf, and you cannot remain in the mosque. And then three things are unlawful for someone in the state of minor ritual impurity, al-hadath. So you just lose your wudu normally. Obviously, you can't pray, you can't do tawaf, and you cannot touch and hold the Quran. Okay, prayer. The discussion of prayer starts with a discussion of the times of prayer. So sometimes when we do the class like this and online and recorded, it's a little bit difficult. So I'll try to do my best. Maybe I'll use my pen because you kind of need like to draw things. I'm going to read this first all the way through and then I'll go back and I'll explain it. There are five daily prayers. The time for the noon prayer, dhuhr prayer. Actually, I won't read it all through. That's just going to be too much. I'll explain it prayer by prayer. The time for the noon prayer begins with the sun passing its zenith, and it ends when the length of an object's shadow minus its shadow of the zenith is the same as its height. So, we said yesterday the zenith is when the sun is in the topmost part of the sky and begins its descent. So let's say that this is a person and the person is standing like this. Now, when the person is standing like this, directly above you, right before Salat al-Dhuhr, right here, there's going to be a little shadow. This is called Dhil al-Zawal. This is the shadow that exists at the time of the zenith. To make things very complicated, this Dhil al-Zawal changes depending on where you are in the world and when you are, what month and what season. So the people, the ulama of the time, there used to be ulama of the times, you know, mawqit, that this was their area of expertise. So when you stand like this and the sun is directly above you, and then the sun begins to move. Just pretend that this is the floor. The sun is above you and it begins to move. Dhuhr, and the sun keeps going like this. This is east and then this is west. So the sun keeps moving like this. And at some point here, the sun will cast a shadow. It will be the length of the object, but you have to remember to minus out that original shadow that existed when the sun was at the topmost. When the shadow of the object is the same length of the object minus this little piece, that's the end of Salat al-Dhuhr. The time for Asr prayer begins at that moment. When the length of the an object's shadow minus its shadow at the zenith, now you know what that means, is greater than the object's height. So at the end of Dhuhr, Asr begins is what he's saying. And then its preferred time ends when the object shadow is twice its height. So in Asr prayer, it's better to pray it early. So the object, its shadow, twice its height, minus that little piece that existed when the sun was in the topmost part of the sky. That's the preferred time. And its permissible time extends until sunset. So in the Shafi'i Madhab, one prayer starts and it ends when the other prayer ends. And then the time of sunset prayer, Maghrib prayer, it's a single time. It begins when the sun sets completely. So let's say the bottom of the camera right here, this is the sun setting. So the sun is setting, it's setting, it's setting. This is still Asr time, 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 still Asr time. Oh, boom. You know, you don't see the sun anymore. But if a little bit, you see the sun, this is still Asr time, the sun sets. At that moment, Maghrib time comes in. Now notice, when the sun sets like this, and it just falls below the horizon, but there's still all of this light shining from the sun. So the minute Maghrib time comes out, if you look outside, you might think, how can it be Maghrib? It's still light. That is Maghrib. Because if you just waited 3 minutes, it would be completely dark again, because the sun continues to fall. That's the beginning of Maghrib, and there's one time for it. That's the time for it. And then he says, it lasts long enough to perform the adhan, to make wudu, and to cover what needs to be covered, and to make the iqamah, and to pray 5 raka'at, the 3 raka'at of Maghrib, and the 2 sunnah after Maghrib. However, this is the old madhab of Imam al-Shafi'i. The new madhab of Imam al-Shafi'i, which is what we follow, is that Maghrib time lasts all the way until the beginning of Isha time, which we'll describe now. The time for Isha prayer begins when the red in the sky disappears. So in the example I said, Maghrib, the sun is setting. At this time, there's going to be red here in the sky. When this red disappears and it becomes white, that's the beginning of Isha prayer. Its preferred time extends until the first third of the night. Its permissible time extends until the beginning of true dawn. So in the Shafi'i madhab, the prayers, you know, they kind of, one starts and one ends. Except for Fajr, because Fajr ends when the sun rises, as we'll see. And then Fajr prayer begins at true dawn. Let's say this is east, and now the sun is rising. Before the sun rises, at a certain degree, how can I do this? Let's say this is east, and this is west. Okay, so the sun is going to come up like this. Yeah, the sun is going to come up like this. So before the sun comes up here, this is Shuruq, this is the end of Fajr, there's a certain angle, if this is the earth, the horizon, there's a certain angle below that where Fajr begins. And then Fajr lasts until the sun rises. That is an area of expertise. That's what true dawn means. So this is not the place or the time to do that, because we don't have the capacity. But in the longer classes, I talk a lot about this. And the degree that if this is the horizon, and this is the sun is coming up this way, at what degree does, when the sun is here below the horizon, is Fajr? You see, this is right here is an angle. That's the area of ijtihad, an area of fiqh. You know, the people that master this, the mawaqit, they talk about what is the angle. And we have volumes and volumes and volumes of books of the ulama from, you know, all over the Muslim world, all ages, who used to calculate that. And that's where the app time comes in, the calculation. Different countries and different fiqh bodies use different angles. I'm not going to get into that now, but that's what it is. And then Fajr time ends when the disk of the sun emerges. When you see the disk of the sun, khalas, that's the end of Salat al-Fajr. And there is no fard prayer from that time until the beginning of Dhuhr, but there is the sunnah of Salat al-Duha. Okay. Sorry, that was a little complicated. I hope I was able to convey that to everybody. Conditions of obligating the prayer. Upon whom is the prayer fard? 3 conditions obligate the prayer. One, must pray if they are a Muslim, obviously, if they are mature, meaning they're old enough, and of sound mind. The combination of these 3 conditions is the definition of legal responsibility, taklif. All of the fiqh that we're going to talk about assumes that a person is mukallaf. What does mukallaf mean? They're a Muslim, they've accepted the shahadatain, they're mature, they have passed puberty, and they are of sound mind. If you hit those 3, then the Sharia is for you. These are the things that you have to do. Recommended prayers. There are 5 recommended prayers. I mean, there are more, but in this little book, he's going to give us 5. the two Eid prayers, Eid al-Fitr and Eid al-Adha, and then the solar and lunar eclipse, Salat al-Kusuf wal-Khusuf, that will come maybe tomorrow, we'll talk about it, and the rain prayer, Salat al-Istisqa. There are 17 rak'ahs of recommended prayers associated with the obligatory daily prayers. So the sunnahs in the Shafi'i madhab are 17 rak'ahs. 2 before Fajr prayer, 4 before Dhuhr, and 2 after, 4 before Asr, 2 before, 2 after sunset, and 3 after the night prayer, with in one cycle, 3 together, which is Salat al-Witr. And then there are extra sunnahs, the nawafil, that are emphasized. Qiyam al-Layl, night prayer, the Duha prayer, which I just mentioned to you, and Taraweeh in the month of Ramadan, and the sunnah in the Shafi'i madhab is that the Taraweeh is 20 rak'ahs. Okay, prerequisites for the prayer. There are 5 prerequisites for the prayer. Number 1 is you have to have the absence of ritual impurity and inexcusable filth. So you have to have wudu, basically, and there can't be any filth on your body. Number 2 is you have to cover your nakedness with clothes that are pure. The nakedness, the awra, will come later. But, you know, from the navel to the knees for the man, and the entire body for the woman except her face and her hands in the Shafi'i madhab. So the woman in the Shafi'i madhab also has to cover her feet. Number 3, praying on something that is pure. 4, knowing that the time has entered. And 5, facing the direction of prayer. So you have to have certainty. You have to know that the time has come in. You have to know that you have wudu. Know that this is the qibla. You stand, Allahu Akbar, and you pray. In 2 situations, it is permissible to deviate from the qibla. 1, if there's intense fear. So if somebody's in the thick of battle, there is a special prayer of fear. He will describe it later. We'll talk about that tomorrow. And 2, if you are praying non-obligatory prayers during a journey while riding a mount. So if you can pray the sunnah prayers on an animal and not face the qibla, that's what the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam did. Just one little moment, I got to check on something very quickly. Okay, there are 18 integrals, arkan, for the prayer mentioned in their order of occurrences. So these 18 things that we're about to take, these are the minimal things required for the prayer to be considered correct. 1 is the intention. 2 is standing when one is capable of doing so. So if you are physically able to stand, you can't pray sitting down. So if I'm in a train or a car, but if I stopped, I was physically able to stand, that means I have to stop and physically stand. I can't pray sitting down. 2, saying the opening, Allahu Akbar. Then reciting the Fatiha, and in the Shafi'i madhab, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim is the first verse of the Fatiha, so you have to recite it with the Basmala. And then doing ruku'ah. And then he says, reposing therein, which is pausing. So you stand, you recite the Fatiha, and then just make ruku'ah and just pause and then move again. So you don't even have to say Allahu Akbar to move or move your hand. These are all sunnahs. We'll talk about that in a moment. So just moving and pausing so you can distinguish between movement and pausing. That's what he means by reposing therein, pausing. So bowing and then reposing therein. Raising straight, reposing therein. Then the first sajda, the first prostration, reposing therein. Sitting between the two sajda, and then reposing therein. And then the final sitting, you know, the final tahiyyat. And then saying the tashahud in the final one. Saying prayers upon the Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, in that tashahud. And then saying the first, assalamu alaikum. Then intending to exit from the prayer and performing the integrals in this order. If you just did that, then the prayer would be valid. So you could literally stand, let's say this is that I could stand facing the Qibla with my hands straight down and say, Allahu Akbar, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin, Iyaka na'budu wa Iyaka nasta'in, Ihdina as-sirata al-mustaqim, sirata al-ladhina an'amta alayhim, غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين آمين. And then I go to sujood twice, and then I sit in the last rak'ah. I don't even have to sit for the second rak'ah tashahud. I sit in the last rak'ah, I do the full tashahud, and salamu alaykum. That would count as a prayer. Now obviously no one's going to pray like that, but you need to know that these are the basic things, because sometimes you are teaching children or a new Muslim, or somebody hasn't been praying and they want to come back to start praying, so you want to make it easy for them, or you're in a difficult place to pray, so you need to pray to be quickly, so quick, and so on and so forth. And then we'll do two more sections and then we'll pause for today. Recommended actions. There are two actions recommended prior to the prayer. One is the adhan and one is the iqamah, obviously. And there are two actions recommended within the prayer. The two sunnahs within the prayer is that second rak'ah tashahud, which is the second rak'ah of Salat al-Dhuhr, Asr, Maghrib, and Isha. Because Salat al-Fajr only has one tashahud, which you have to do. And then the second sunnah in the Shafi'i Madhab is Dua al-Qunut in the second rak'ah of Fajr prayer. So when we say Sami Allahu liman hamida, the second rak'ah of Fajr prayer, then we do the dua. And then the lesser, let me read for you the 15 lesser sunnahs, which are called al-hay'at. Now there's another, so we did the arkan, the things that you have to do. Then the two sunnahs, the first tashahud, and then the dua al-qunut. And now is even lesser than that, which are called hay'at, lesser recommended acts. Number one is to raise the hands while you say the opening Allahu Akbar. And to raise the hands when you come up from ruku'ah, Sami Allahu liman hamida. And to raise the hands when you say Allahu Akbar to go down to ruku'ah. So to go like this, and that the thumb is at the where the ear is. See, my ear is here. So like this. So you say Allahu Akbar to enter the prayer. And then to go to ruku'ah, Allahu Akbar. And then Sami Allahu liman hamida. And then you drop your hands down. Placing the right hand over the left like this, so Allahu Akbar, and like this, the right hand grabs the wrist of the left hand. Saying the opening dua, there are many of them that you can find in Imam al-Nawawi's Kitab al-Adhkar. Saying A'udhu Billahi Minash Shaitan Rajeem before the Basmala. And then audible utterances when appropriate, so Salatul Fajr, Maghrib and Isha, the first two rakas to recite the Quran loudly. And then quiet utterances when appropriate, like Salat al-Dhuhr and Asr. Number seven is saying Ameen after the Fatiha, whether you're by yourself or in Jama'ah. Number eight, reciting a chapter of the Quran after the Fatiha. So for the first two rak'ahs, it's a sunnah or a hay'ah to recite something after the Fatiha. Saying Allahu Akbar when rising and descending. So to move from each movement, you say Allahu Akbar, except standing, you say Sami Allahu liman hamida. Saying Sami Allahu liman hamida, Rabbana lakal hamd, when you stand up from ruku'ah. Saying Subhana Rabbi al-Azim when you're in ruku'ah, and Subhana Rabbi al-A'la when you're in sujood. Placing one's hands upon one's thighs while sitting. Number 12, I don't want to read it, it's too complicated, but how do you sit in the tashahud? So your left hand is on your knee, your left knee like this, and then your right hand is on your right knee like this, and then you curl these fingers, and then your pointer rests upon your thumb like this. So imagine I'm sitting in tashahud. At-tahiyyatu lillahi wa salatu tayyibatu salamu alayka ayyuhan nabiyyu wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh salamu alayna wa ibadillahi as-salihin ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna sayyidina muhammadur rasulullah. And then for the rest of the tashahud, I keep my finger extended, but not like this, slightly bent. Like this, until I say Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. That's what he's describing, and that's the Shafi'i way of praying. And then sitting in the manner of iftirash in all places when one sits, but sitting in the manner of tawarruk in the final sitting. So iftirash is that your left foot is like this, and then your right foot is planted like this and your butt is sitting on your left foot. But for the last rak'ah, you swing your left foot underneath you so your left butt is on the floor and then your right foot is pointed down. And then saying the second, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Okay. I hope that that was clear. We're going to pause here, inshallah, and we'll say, Wallahu ta'ala a'la wa a'lam, wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa maulana Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. I'll see you all tomorrow at the same time to continue our discussion. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.